Thank you for ordering this lecture from movementlectures.com. This lecture, Self-Limiting Exercise, is 30 minutes and was recorded for you by Gray Cook.
Today we're going to talk about self-limiting exercise. I mentioned it in my book, Movement, and I've heard the topic batted around since the publication of that book quite a bit. I've used the term for a long, long time in my teaching, but almost got re-energized about the term when going through Christopher McDougall's book, Born to Run. He used the term self-limiting to describe what happens when we decide to run with bare feet. Obviously, footwear, specifically modern running footwear, allows our feet to maybe not interact with the environment in the sensory way it was designed. Our feet, both the pressure receptors and the superficial tactile receptors, are shielded from the environment. Therefore, the environment doesn't get a chance to communicate to us how we should interact with the environment. Now, don't get me wrong, gloves and shoes are absolute great inventions. They keep us from shredding up our hands and our feet, and our hands and our feet are full of neurological endings. Outside of your face, probably going to see the highest concentrations there. But the point is, we interact with our environment with our hands and our feet. When you develop your entire running cadence with the sensory deprivation provided by a shoe, you don't move based on sensory input. Well, that's one of the summary factors of the book Movement. Perception is what really drives our behavior. The way we perceive a situation is usually linked to the way we behave in response. Now, if we deprive ourselves of perceptive quality, or if we diminish perceptive quality, wouldn't it also be appropriate to assume that behavior is going to be somehow diminished or inadequate? Think about that. Psychologists will adhere to this: perception drives behavior. If you want to change someone's behavior, you can either educate them a little bit, but if you truly change their perception, there's a better opportunity to do that. Barefoot running has all kinds of mechanical influences behind it. We know that with a shoe, you can run with a heel strike. Barefoot, you can't do it. Your heel's just too sensitive, and you were made to land on the mid part of your foot and your forefoot. Immediately by removing your shoes, if we had you run on grass on a safe and non-noxious or painful surface, we would see a couple of things. If you had no preconceived idea, you would probably shorten your stride, midfoot strike, and take on a more upright posture if we made you barefoot as opposed to running shoes. Running shoes allow you to stride out and almost exaggerate the walking gait, which does involve a heel strike, but there's very little impact. So efficient walking utilizes the heel strike and the contact of ground in front of you, where efficient jogging and running barefoot require that your foot strike somewhat under your body and propel you forward by extending behind you. Walking is reaching out and grabbing ground with your heel and coming over it. And jogging and running are literally a controlled fall forward as you propel yourself by a push from behind. Now, people are going to try to turn this into a running biomechanics lecture, and it's not. It's basically using barefoot running as a simplistic way to talk about self-limiting exercise. Let me give you another concept of self-limiting exercise. One of the beautiful things that true coaches and teachers realize is a self-limiting exercise or activity is going to limit your volume and intensity based on your technical precision. One of my favorite examples of this is jump rope. Most people can jog or run longer than they can jump rope. Now, the cardiovascular mechanism is largely the same. In many cases, the plyometric demand of jump rope, if you think about it, is even less. Now, the difference is jump rope sometimes takes a 2-foot landing, jogging takes a 1-foot landing, but the loads are actually distributed better in jump rope. But jump rope sort of has an extra wrinkle to it. The fact that the rope is going around in revolutions requires you to have precision and posture in what you do. I've told people you can slouch and jog, but it's very, very hard to slouch and jump rope. The fact that the rope is revolving around your body with an axis basically at your grip of the handles, that axis falls very close to your center of mass. So that axis sort of depicts any asymmetry, forward lean, backward lean, left lean, right lean, or unnecessary rotation you have. If you revolve the rope anywhere but the true axis of the center of you, then what's going to happen is you're going to catch the rope on your foot and it's going to frustrate you. And guess what? There's going to be a lot of starting and stopping of your jump rope session, but that's the point. You can't do enough jump rope to get shin splints or shred up your legs. But many people who are inefficient runners will basically pound the ground until they have an orthopedic issue. So self-limiting exercise exposes you to a level of technical precision that will not let you participate in greater levels of volume or intensity without greater levels of precision. The greater levels of precision, in fact, are protective because the greater levels of precision perpetuate better alignment, better coordination, better motor control, and better attention to detail. Let's take another self-limiting exercise, a bottom-up kettlebell activity. Well, let's pick three. The first bottom-up kettlebell activity is simply walking. Bring the kettlebell to a bottom-up position and rack it so that your elbow is bent and the kettlebell is carried to the side of your body close to your chin. Get a comfortable position and just start walking. As you shift weight from the left to right side of your body, you're going to have to make small adjustments, not just with your shoulder and grip, but with your core, with your balance, with your posture. Now, you've got two options. You can basically try to responsibly grip the kettlebell and balance it atop you through your precision and alignment as you walk, or you can try to crush the living guts out of the kettlebell handle and experience what grip fatigue feels like about a minute from now. Give it the amount of tension it needs, but no extra tension. Use your balance, precision, and alignment to create efficiency. And show me a long walk with the kettlebell carried with a bent elbow held upside down with the barrel or ball part of the kettlebell close to your chin. Then show me you can do it on the other side of your body. Many people will have abilities with this in one side of their body, but not the other. They want to blame it on grip strength, but you don't know how many times we've done this. We've taken a grip dynamometer out and showed their right and left grip strength in the position is largely the same. Their attention to detail, their precision, their coordination, their motor control, and their balance, however, are not. So the fact that you have an inability on one side can only partially be related to a grip strength issue. And if you truly think it's a grip strength issue, it's easy enough to test. A grip dynamometer will expose you to that weakness right away, and you can find out if it's an orthopedic issue or just a poorly trained grip on one side. But we rarely see huge asymmetries in grip. Even if you're right-handed, we rarely see a greater than 10% difference. The thing that should be compelling is bottom-up kettlebell activity. Whether you're carrying it, whether you're pressing it overhead, or whether you do a front squat with it on one side of your body, any asymmetry between the left and right side of your body's ability to do that should forecast a disharmony of alignment, balance, precision, and motor control, and not simply be a knee-jerk reaction to say, oh yeah, I got a weak grip on that side. So how would the activity start? Bring the kettlebell to the appropriate position and just walk around with it. If you can't walk around with it, there's a good chance you shouldn't be pressing it. Once you can walk around with it for an equal volume between the left and right side, start perfecting your kettlebell front squat, not your press. It's going to have a little bit of the help of a goblet squat, meaning we've got ballast in the front of us, so it almost acts as a heel lift. We can get a little bit of that squat correction. But holding that bottom-up kettlebell in front of you and dropping into a squat is going to keep you from forward leaning, because if you do, you're going to dump the kettlebell. It's going to force you to engage certain things and start your squat from a better aligned position. As you descend into your squat, your low back and pelvis relationship is going to change. The angle of your hip to your pelvis is going to change. The angle of your hip to your knee is going to change, and the angle of your knee to your ankle is going to change. Many different fascial planes will change their tension. Many different anatomy trains will change their role. And as you go down and come back up through that squat, you will learn that you can adjust your shoulder and your holding power of that kettlebell regardless of what happens in your lower body. This is what we call in sports training or even rehabilitation, dissociation. When we see people who can't balance as they turn, somehow their torso and their pelvis is so stuck and so connected that they can't separate the two. But the fluid reciprocal action that we see when you walk and jog between your upper and lower body doing almost opposite things is what we consider natural movement. That harmony, that reciprocal action we see in dance, we see in fighting, we see in people doing gymnastics work or trapeze work, and we see it and we call that fluid athletic form. Well, really what it is that rhythmical balance that when we move one segment of our body, we counterbalance with another. When that's gone, we call that a lack of dissociation. We want the shoulders to be able to turn while the legs can still do their job. And when we see a lack of that, we realize that you're having to do unnecessary support with one part of your body to just achieve a minimum level of competence with another part of your body. That's almost what we call compensation. But the bottom-up kettlebell, if you just listen to it, will expose you to disharmonies, malalignments, and motor control issues. My suggestion to you, do your bottom-up walking in a carry position, and then equalize your amount of bottom-up front squatting. Once done, you may want to investigate your equality on bottom-up kettlebell pressing. Don't do it fast. Don't see how many you can knock out. Press it up, bring it back down, cycle a breath, show me that you've regained posture and press it up again. Going that slow may cost you a few reps, but all I'm really looking for is an accurate appraisal between the right and left side. Most people don't want to expose themselves to this type of scrutiny. They'd rather gut through and see how many presses they could do so they could get over to their keyboard and post their superior achievement on the internet for all to read. But I really hate the fact that modern fitness accomplishment has digressed to the fact that it doesn't exist unless you can blog about it or tweet it. But the whole point is self-limiting exercise is about you and your own movement and precision. When I went through the MoveNat experience this past summer with Erwan LaCour and his instructors, Cliff and Vic, many times we would get smoked or fatigued doing a climbing activity or a crawling activity, and we quickly find ourselves on a balance beam. Now, the balance beam didn't have a high energy expenditure, but it had a high attention to detail. They would drop pearls of wisdom on us and not tell us how to balance, but talk to us about our breathing, talk to us about slowing it down and feeling what the beam wants us to do with our feet, not trying to balance by swaying our upper body back and forth or holding unnecessary tone in our arms, but using our legs, both as sensory and motor organs, to find out what's needed, and then execute what's required. So we would take a step forward, we'd take a step backward, we would close our eyes, we would deprive ourselves of sensory information and then move back into it. It was enlightening to see how much better people's balance got even in the presence of fatigue, because once again, we were bringing way more muscle activity and malalignment to the act of balancing. And balancing, which should not be fatiguing, often was for many of us. So they reversed it. They got us fatigued and said, figure out how to balance in the presence of fatigue. And when we did, we learned to balance more efficiently. The balance beam was self-limiting. It didn't allow our stance and preferred posture to disconnect us from the true laws of gravity and our limits of stability over our base of support. Climbing is a great self-limiting activity. It pits us against our body weight and uses both our mobility and stability together. Climbers don't usually test out stiff. Part of the efficiency in climbing is not just the pound-for-pound body strength that a climber has, but it's the mobility of their arms and legs and even the mobility of their trunk that allows them to achieve optimal alignment and maximize their leverage. Think about it. Getting into a good position is probably more important than increasing your strength 10% more. Most elite level golfers work on their precision and execution of their posture and movement patterns, knowing if they will just get the right biomechanical lines of attack as they swing, they will be more efficient. That's why they spend more time with a golf club working on their mechanics and technical precision than doing bicep curls or kettlebell presses. They appreciate that strengthening their body will help, but no amount of strength in the world is going to make you efficient if part of your strength is used to overcome your own stiffness or work against your own malalignment. The object of efficiency is to be able to reproduce an activity with some degree of technical precision so as not to waste energy. If your complete training paradigm is just caloric expenditure with no regard for accomplishment, then it doesn't really matter what you do. You can take someone who's morbidly obese and moving poorly and just make them move in any number of ways, and they will have caloric expenditure. But if you do that often enough, guess what? Their lack of integrity and precision in movement is going to bring them up against early fatigue, where they won't really achieve the most of their metabolic efficiency, and therefore they won't lose weight and they won't get in shape quick. They'll just hit fatigue, create lactic acid, go into a poor breathing state, get tired, and go eat. Or they'll have an orthopedic issue. So either way, your quest for caloric expenditure should be sidelined. And what you should do is create a situation where, even if weight loss is your goal, go for technical precision, movement correction, movement efficiency whenever possible. Make your people as efficient as possible, and believe it or not, work levels will become more pleasurable and they'll be able to do more, and at the same time reduce their musculoskeletal risk of a setback injury as they're getting in shape. I gave an incomplete list of self-limiting exercise in the movement book. And here's where I went with it. Because I get credited for introducing the functional movement screen and the medical counterpart of the functional movement screen, the selective functional movement assessment, people defer to me for corrective strategy. And I really, really have to emphasize this. I don't think that I want to put somebody on a path of corrective strategy for the rest of their life. That's not why I'm here. Now, if they're moving at such a state of dysfunction that I know they're at risk for an injury, I want them on a corrective strategy till the movement deficiency goes away. But once it's gone, I don't want it to return. Well, there's two ways to hopefully guarantee that. One, make corrective exercise a part of your life forever. That's called supplementation. The other is eat a healthy enough diet where you don't need to supplement nutritionals. I'm using a nutritional analogy there. Think about it. If you then got your movement patterns corrected, got your movement profile cleaned up, but then adopted a different approach to exercise, whereas instead of going headlong into your preferred activities and then having to clean up the movement dysfunction that laid in the path of your activity, why not adopt some activities that forced you to maintain your mobilities and your stabilities and your movement patterns in such a way that even though you might train in one special direction, the variety of activity you have in another direction somehow naturally maintains your balance of power? Originally, I think that was the definition of cross-training, but somehow we lost that message. The amount of dosage that it takes you not to have detriment from your specialization should be cross-training. Think about that again. Every one of us wants to specialize in something. We have these things we like to do: golf, triathlon, lifting heavy weight. It doesn't matter. But your cross-training, if done correctly, is a certain dosage of activity that undoes any of the detriments that specialization may cause. What are some of the detriments specialization may cause? Neglect of a certain movement pattern, limitation in a movement pattern, or left-right asymmetry. So if we could inject natural activities alongside some of our favorite activities, and those natural activities were somehow self-limiting, jump rope, bottom-up kettlebells, balancing, they would basically keep us in a highly adaptable state. The reason specialization is sometimes detrimental is it hurts our adaptability. Is it possible to be specialized and not lose adaptability? Absolutely. I can introduce you to two strength coaches in the NFL that do that for a living. They take what you do well, better than anybody else, and keep that from undoing you. Specialization will undo you because the human body was made to have a variety of movements. And those movements are not just our natural birthright. They are very restorative in nature. I would ask all of you to go to the website that we dedicated to the movement book, movementbook.com, and look for the lecture in either chapter 2 or 3 by Dr. Ed Thomas that really talks about the restorative nature of certain activities or the maintenance that certain activities can provide. Our ancestors participated in certain activities and didn't have all the special screening or corrective lingo that we use today. But they seemed to just know, just like a variety of nutritionals was probably the most holistic diet, a variety of exercises was also good. It's okay to specialize, but if your specialization makes your basic movement capabilities diminished in any certain way, and you're not in contention for a gold medal, then you may be taking unnecessary risk with your training. So self-limiting exercise is something that you don't introduce to correct an ailment or a problem that hasn't been successfully diagnosed or identified. That's not why you do it. That's not why we jump on a balance beam. We jump on a balance beam to make sure that the extra strength or explosiveness that we just developed in our legs didn't hurt our ability to feel our environment and respond accordingly to challenges in balance and our limits of stability. One of the things I really appreciated about the MoveNat experience was there weren't structured, anatomically correct, ergonomically engineered hand grips on the trees that we climbed or on the ropes we pulled on. We basically had to figure out how to grip, how to align, how to move naturally. And unfortunately, for some reason, none of these trees were clones of each other. Each was different in a little way. Each rocky path that we hiked on had rocks in different places. So we had to pay attention to what we were doing. We had to be aware. A word I like to use is we had to be engaged. Self-limiting exercises forces a slightly higher degree of engagement. That degree of engagement sometimes can create frustration. It can push us right up to our limits of capacity and stability. But if you listen to The Talent Code or Talent is Overrated, either of these books tell us that the best of the best may not be naturally talented. Their talent may be their ability to train at superior levels than us. They expose themselves to better feedback during a training session than we do, and that superior level of feedback helps them hone their skill and learn at a more accelerated rate than we learn. Isn't that what self-limiting exercises do to us? Isn't the jump rope telling us we're not doing it right? Isn't the bottom-up kettlebell, as it becomes wobbly, telling us we're doing something wrong? Shouldn't we stay there and challenge ourselves in a particular session for a particular amount of time to explore all our different options? Or should we stop the session right there and go Google the answer? Which is going to give you more inherent body knowledge? Which is going to help you overcome the problem? I hate to say it, but many of our ancestors overcame movement problems without ever verbalizing the problem. They never really encapsulated or articulated what the problem was verbally, yet they found the solution through moving, through becoming efficient, through developing body mechanics, through being engaged. Now, we want a verbal answer in a movement situation that doesn't work with words. Your reactions, your natural movement reactions, the things you do when you're trying to balance, don't necessarily need to be converted into words as the signal comes up from your foot. The signal comes up from your foot and things happen. You shift weight. You don't know you're moving forward in the sagittal plane or rotating in the transverse plane. You just do it because your equilibrium, your vision, and your proprioception tell you to do it. So we've got to put ourselves and the people who train under us in situations where they're actually correcting at a nonverbal level. They're moving, they're reacting, they're feeling. The language of movement is written in feel, not in pictures and not in words. And most of us learn to move and even learn to walk with very little verbal or visual instruction. Our need to interact with our environment made us lift our head, made us roll to the left, roll to the right, push up on our elbows. Once again, just so we could interact and see more. Eventually we learned we could get from point A to point B crawling, and that crawling strengthened our little limbs and our trunk to the point where we could come up on our knees. That gave us an even better perspective. But we weren't satisfied there because there's furniture all around. So we pulled up onto one knee and even stood. We fell a bunch of times, cracked our head on the coffee table, had a lot of boo-boos, made a lot of people laugh. But eventually we learned that upright, bipedal locomotion was about the most efficient thing we could do to get from point A to point B. And it also positioned our eyes, our favorite sense in the world, to gain the most information and the most perspective. If you look at the book Brain Rules, you'll see how our brain craves that sensory information, and that sensory information drives many of our movement behaviors. Those movement behaviors can be honed and corrected if we limit them using natural things in our environment, our balance. I think one of the reasons that both barefoot running or minimalist shoe running and stand-up paddleboarding are two of the fastest growing movements in fitness and recreation right now is because there is a limitation. You've got to really own an authentic running stride if you're going to use a minimalist shoe or go barefoot or go in a stripped down piece of footwear. And you really got to own your balance and paddle stroke, your upper body strength and your lower body stability if you're going to stand on a big, long, floaty surfboard with a 7-foot paddle for many people and pull on that thing. The strongest people don't necessarily paddle the fastest, and the people with the best balance don't necessarily go anywhere. You've got to have a blend of a nice technical pull on a paddle without giving up your balance on the board. I listed all of these things as ways to limit ourselves. I also got to spend some time with John Brookfield this summer, and John revealed many of his training systems to me. And one of the things that John has arrived at is one of the things I saw in MoveNat and I've seen in other training modalities, and it's something about going back to that crawling posture, not on your hands and knees, but on your hands and feet, more of a bear crawling. And learning how to move in that position creates core engagement automatically as you advance your upper and lower limbs in a reciprocal fashion. I have seen the corrective nature of bear crawling because I'm in a position to movement screen people and suggest certain activities. Some are surgical precision corrective exercises, and some are delete this activity in your programming and add this one in place of it. So there are two ways to change someone's movement profile or movement screen. We can correct, or we could delete the abundance of one activity and insert something that's going to be somewhat difficult, almost seem like a setback. It's almost going to humble you in its natural limitations. And that amount of humbling creates an adaptive drive inside your brain and body, and you come out of the other side moving a little bit better. I've given you a lot of philosophy, but what I want you to do is explore some of the activities that you personally do and some of those activities that you suggest others do. Find out how many are dependent on metabolic limitation, how many are dependent on musculoskeletal limitation, and how many are dependent on technical precision. I would suggest that if a lot of the activities that we do ourselves and we have other people doing are limited by technical precision, meaning you can't do more of them if you don't do them right, would yield better physical specimens than those people who mindlessly bang out extra repetitions only so they can get to their keyboard and tell people how many they did. I'd rather see you do a very few correctly than a significant number with all kinds of compensation and substitution. And I'm not trying to take that away from you. I'm glad you did that. What I'm worried about is the uninformed person watching you thinking that's the epitome of physical development. Think about all the different things. A farmer's carry of 2 kettlebells. That's self-limiting. See how many more you can add to the list and see if you can make your own list before you maybe revisit that page in the movement book where I gave you sort of a list of self-limiting exercises. Brett Jones and I talked about that on movementbook.com, so go find that video as well. Thank you so much for your time today, and that's my lecture today on self-limiting exercise. This is Greg Cook.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture from movementlectures.com. We add several new lectures each month to serve your mobile listening and continuing education needs. Please visit movementlectures.com to make your new audio lecture choice, or to provide feedback on this lecture or other topic choices or presenters you'd like to hear.